Hello, you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. This episode is about predicting the next big virus epidemic. With diseases like Ebola and Zika dominating the headlines in recent years, how can we be ready for the outbreaks of the future? Well, part of the answer is to go out into areas where there's a high risk of diseases spilling over from animals into humans and just start looking for any pathogens that might pose a threat. When you think about just how many viruses could be lurking out there in animal ecosystems, that certainly seems like a daunting task, but it's exactly what PREDICT is trying to do. PREDICT is a program from the One Health Institute at UC Davis and the United States Agency for International Development. And this month, Benjamin Thompson caught up with the global director.
So PREDICT is a project that is looking to move the needle from the responsive way that we deal with epidemics and pandemics and move it into a more proactive place where we know what viruses are out there in the world and we know where to expect them so that we can be prepared. My name is Jonna Mazet, and I'm a professor of epidemiology and disease ecology, as well as the director of the One Health Institute at the University of California, Davis.
Having met you in the US last month at the Emerging Disease Conference, it seems that scientists are maybe focusing on zoonotic viruses, so viruses that move from animals to humans. Now, why is that a particular area that people are focusing on?
We're really looking at those viruses that could jump from one species to another. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that most of the emerging infectious diseases that we have seen in the past couple of decades have been those that can be shared between animals and people. And most of those have been those that have jumped from wild species, wild animals, into people. Now, that shouldn't surprise us. I think a lot of times people think, wow, why are we looking at bats and rodents and monkeys at their viruses? Well, we are now the naive population, if you will, the new world for those viruses. So when we push ourselves further and further into territory that we haven't been using before, because humans are sort of encroaching on every piece of the earth, we now become exposed to viruses that we weren't exposed to before that are in those hosts.
On our blog, we had something about Nipah virus a few months ago, and I think that's maybe a good example of where people are moving closer into bat territory. Is that the sort of thing?
It is a great example, and the Nipah example is one where we did see a spillover from a bat. A virus that got into palm sap that people like to drink and have been drinking for a long, long time. And it also shows us that we can see spillover into other animals like pigs. And then people are working intimately. You don't get much more intimate than eating another animal. So when we see those spillovers into the food chain, we get especially worried because we can see amplification in our domestic animal hosts, and of course we interact with those even more closely and frequently than we do with wild animals.
So it seems like to me then we need to combine molecular virology with veterinary science, and I think people call that a One Health approach. Is that right?
The way we think about it here is two-pronged. And one is that we know that the health of humans, animals, and the environment are inextricably linked. We can't think about one without the other. If we do, it's to our folly. So we lose if we don't think about animal health when we think about how to respond to Ebola, because that's where Ebola was hiding, right? And that's how it spilled over into people. We lose when we don't think about environmental health because it's about how we're moving out into the forest and interacting with those species. The other prong of One Health is the collaborative nature. So it's bringing together all of the disciplines that you need to address a problem. And I think that's where, as a human race, if you will, we've failed ourselves with science, is that we've been taught to go off and work super hard and be brilliant in our laboratories or our own experiments and thinking that we might have that one discovery that will save the world. And really, I think the community is realizing that you can't do it with one discipline. You have to bring the different disciplines together. So in PREDICT, we certainly do have veterinary scientists as well as virologists, but we also have human health professionals, public health experts, policy experts, social scientists, anthropologists, so we can think about behavior change, economists, so that we can think about how all of these pieces work together in a global economy, and also folks like ecologists that can help us future and look at how we reduce risk and reduce, hopefully, our impact on the planet at the same time.
Well, you talk about Ebola there, and I think that's a fine example where potentially we were a little bit more reactive to an outbreak. The outbreak had already occurred and had spread relatively widely across West Africa. And it seems like, to me, PREDICT is trying to be more proactive and getting the information there early. Is that the sort of thing it's for?
Exactly what it's for. So there are a couple problems we're facing right now. One is we haven't done the hard work to figure out where these viruses are. We know what viruses are already in people, but we don't know where the viruses are that are available to spill over into people, like Ebola, Nipah, the ones you mentioned. SARS and MERS are other examples of severe respiratory diseases that can spill over, and we've seen that happen. Now, what we tend to do is we have a scare and then we chase that scare. So we spend the next years and billions of dollars, frankly, globally, to be prepared for that last one. But we don't ever really invest until just recently in how to be prepared for the next one. I will say the influenza community has done this best by thinking forwardly, but without the data of all the viruses that are out there, it's very, very difficult to predict, if you will, where these viruses will hit next and which ones there will be. So what we're trying to do is get a handle on that. Right now, we just have the ability to work in a small suite of countries, if you think about the global scale. So we're working in about 30 countries to understand the hosts, the viruses, and how the ecological and epidemiological circumstances or the patterns of our behavior and activities interact with those viruses to make the opportunity for spillover and then the amplification, like I mentioned, in the food chain, and eventually spread from human to human. So we hope to show with PREDICT, which we have been able to show, that if you go out and look, you can find about 1,000 of these viruses in families that are likely to be able to spill over. But we'd also like to show the scientific community, the public health community, that we could switch the paradigm and get ahead of these things if we were to work together as a global consortium, bigger than the 30 countries that we're working in now, and really get together as a world community. We could get out there and find all the viruses, and it's doable. And we're calling that now the Global Virome Project. And there's some momentum from folks all around the world to get involved.
Well, let's talk about the Virome Project in a minute, because I think it's an enormous undertaking. But I mean, you mentioned there you're working in 30 countries, and also you're looking at zoonotic diseases. Which countries are they in particular, and why did you maybe choose those ones?
So we can use history and models to help us anticipate the ecological circumstances that are occurring around the world that are conducive to this kind of spillover. So what we've been able to do is, again, looking backward, unfortunately, instead of forward, we've been able to say, what are those circumstances, and make a hotspot map. And we're constantly using more and more data to improve that hotspot map. It tells us where we expect to see viruses spill over and catch fire, if you will. And that tends to be in the tropics. That's for a few reasons. One, the population growth, the expansion of human population density is greatest in those areas right now. Biodiversity is also greatest. So the availability of those hosts coupled with people moving into their habitat, it gives that opportunity for exposure. In addition, new work that our team has been doing is showing that the change of land use. So in any direction, you take a farm and you convert it to urban area, or you take a farm and you convert it back to a national park. But that ecological change is a disruption that the animals, hosts, viruses, people get out of balance for some period of time. And it seems that that movement, that change of the balance, allows for the opportunity for spillover and spread for a lot of different reasons, including the stress of the individuals that might make them more susceptible to viruses.
So it seems that the infrastructure is super important in these places as well. I mean, to go back to Ebola again, a lot of these countries in West Africa had very poor sort of public health care initiatives and set up, only because the government has to decide where to put its money in the first place. So what sort of work are you doing on this as well?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's not the scientific side of me that says this, but the very practical observant side, if you will, that in the 7 years that we've been working on this project, I think that the most immediate realization of change that we're seeing is that everywhere we work, we're working with the governments of the countries and the universities in the countries to put together the laboratory infrastructure and the capabilities to actually detect new viruses. So again, going back to Ebola, if they hadn't had to wait for months for outside help to help detect and identify that it was Ebola virus and not a virus like Lisa virus that they were expecting in their country, we would have potentially been able to control the viral outbreak much sooner at its source, because we would have known what we were dealing with. The way it is in many countries around the world, you don't have that infrastructure. You don't have that capacity. So we're super proud that in the 30 countries where we're working, there's now at least one lab, if not two, a human health and an animal health lab that can detect and, if you will, discover viruses.
And it seems like that's so important. I mean, I've spoken to people who work at the MRC virus laboratory in Entebbe in Uganda, and about this kind of local scientists doing locally relevant work. But what sort of research are you training people to do? And are they going out in the field to look for samples? What sort of data are they going to collect?
Yeah, so in all of the countries, we have, again, amazing field teams, scientists that have been trained, again, as ecologists, biologists, veterinarians, human health professionals that get out in the field. They get samples from the wild species carefully to protect themselves and also the wildlife. We don't injure or hurt the wildlife when we take samples. We release them. We're conservationists. They also go to hospitals in those same catchment areas where we're looking at the animals, and they look at sick people with fevers of unknown origin, all the undiagnosed diseases that are going on in these regions. Also the people in and working with animals, so that occupationally exposed, as well as their livestock that are in and around the wildlife. So by triangulating in this way, we can see which viruses are sharing and what the traits are of those viruses that help us look across the spectrum and identify characteristics of the viruses that allow them to jump from species to species.
Well, I mean, on that then, what sort of data have we got on spillover events? I mean, I guess you only need one to occur for an outbreak potentially to happen. But what do we know about the nature of spilling over?
I think we're learning all the time. We know about the dramatic ones, obviously, but we also get our attention distracted by the big scary ones, and we miss the little ones. And even during the big West African Ebola outbreak, you know, there was another smaller outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo that went almost unreported because so much was happening elsewhere that was so devastating. But it is testament to a country that knows what it has, is ready for it, and has the laboratory capacity to detect it and the preemptive procedures in place to deal with it. So we were able to help. Our team was there in DRC. Actually, the DRC government's team was helping in West Africa. So we were glad that our team was still there in DRC to help detect and identify the Ebola virus there in DRC, and be able to say it's not the same strain that's happening right now in West Africa, because there were fear everywhere that the virus was moving by travelers and things. So we were able able to say, no, this is a strain from DRC and we need to get it under control. There was also the trust of the public there because there's been that outreach, again, because the country knows what to expect and is able to put those educational and infrastructural procedures in place, which is beyond the healthcare system, but actually the trust with the government and the healthcare system of the people.
Well, let's use Ebola as a stepping stone then. I know the reservoir seems to be great apes and gorillas and what have you. And you've been talking about trying to catalogue all the viruses on Earth, potentially, which seems like an incredible undertaking. But one of the things that I'm super interested in is how you go about cataloguing viruses of great apes. And I know you've done some amazing work, you and your team, on getting these samples. What sort of things have you done?
Yeah, so we're lucky to be able to work with organizations, again, the in-country organizations that are trying to protect species, like the great apes. And in Uganda, Rwanda, and DRC, for example, we work with the Gorilla Doctors Program that is engaged with the governments, is an NGO organization, but is protecting the apes. And so there we're able to really practice the One Health approach where we're looking at the park workers and we're looking at the great apes, the endangered species. And what we find are viruses certainly that are capable of spilling over to people, but just as importantly for us and the apes and our real-time kind of activities, we found viruses circulating, the regular strains of things that cause symptoms like common cold that have actually killed mountain gorillas in that year when they're circulating in human populations. So we also know that we have to do a better job of protecting the species and the biodiversity on this planet that's so important to a healthy globe.
Well, I mean, it can't be easy to get a sample from a gorilla or from a monkey, I suppose. I imagine if you try and tranquilize them, they're off into the jungle. You can't keep up with them. So how would one go about trying to get a sample, a saliva sample, say, from a gorilla or a monkey or a chimp or anything like that?
Yeah, so we've got also some wonderful research collaborations, and we've been able to come up with different techniques. So we can certainly dart the gorillas and the monkeys, but that's very invasive. Takes a huge amount of people and resources. Instead, we are able to look at chewed plants and also come up with techniques like ropes that you can bait with a little strawberry jam. We've tested all the different ropes to see which ones are the best for pulling virus out. We've been able to test that with our zoo colleagues to see if we swab the animal and we compare that to our ropes, whether we get the same viruses, so we know we're doing rigorous work. And so we know what rope material is best. We know what attractant works best and doesn't inhibit our diagnostic techniques later. And it makes for good photos as well.
So strawberry jam, then, that's the key, is it?
In Asia, they like strawberry jam. In other places, sometimes it's banana.
I love it. Okay, well, I mean, we're leading then into the cataloging phase, and I think you're talking about it there. And I've said it a few times there, it seems like an unbelievable undertaking. I mean, we could swab the room I'm in right now and discover countless new microbes, new bacteria, new viruses. I mean, how on earth do you go about it, and where do you start, and what are you expecting to find?
You know, we do put some filters on this to narrow our activities. So what we've done is we've looked at viral families, taxonomic families, that have caused disease in people in the past, so epidemics and pandemics. But we sort of narrow our focus for the majority of our samples to those viral families, but there are a lot of them. There are about over 20 viral families that we're looking at. We also do something called metagenomics, where we go in and actually look at all the nucleic acid, DNA and RNA, in a sample, but that's very expensive, so we do that on a smaller subset, but we don't want to miss anything that might be there. But we really do focus most of our effort on those things that we know can make people sick. But then what we do is more than just a catalog of finding those viruses, we're kind of calling it an atlas. I'm not sure if that's as descriptive as we need it to be, but we get all of the data surrounding the circumstances of the viruses that we find. So that ecological, again, epidemiological data, the circumstance data that allows us to put a level of risk on the potential for spillover that we've never been able able to do before. So we want to understand, is this a virus we found in a very rare species, it deep in a forest in a cave where people are unlikely to ever interact with that? Well, that's going to go lower on our list for causing a spillover in an epidemic than a virus that we're finding in bats that are sort of hanging out in people's homes and people don't even notice they're in the attic, but they're constantly being exposed to those viruses. So we're getting that metadata to help us understand the potential for spillover amplification and spread, as well as the viruses. But we do think there's probably about 500,000 viruses out there able to spill over that we haven't detected yet. And that characterization work needs to be done if we're ever going to get to the sort of weather service style prediction of where and how viruses will spill over.
What sort of things then have you found? I mean, I guess when I think of viruses that potentially could cause, disease in humans, I'm imagining coronaviruses, something like that. Are those the sort of things you found?
Yeah, so we've found over 100 coronaviruses in our work. And so we've really expanded that catalog of coronaviruses that I think 20 years ago, we would have talked about as being sort of things that humans, we weren't too worried about, kind of causing the cold. We knew they were out there. But then SARS came and then MERS came. And so we've seen these deadly outbreaks in people. So we do need to understand this class of virus much more. So there's lots of excellent work, and we're collaborating with some of the best professionals around the world when we find the new coronaviruses to help characterize and figure out if they are capable of infecting human cells. And if not, what hosts are they infecting now, and be able to monitor that for change in case they might recombine and be able to infect human cells.
I mean, people might then say, if this is just a cataloging exercise, what are the benefits then? And what are the tangible things that maybe you would come back to them and say, well, actually, this is why we're doing this?
Yeah, so we have good evidence, right? I gave you a couple of examples, like the DRC outbreak, where real time showing that if we improve these systems as we go, we can reduce the death toll. But really, I think what we want to do is understand all the circumstances around these viruses, know where these viruses are, because as a scientific community, we're constantly being asked, what's the next one? Where's the next one? And people who tell us, well, you're just making a catalog, I will tell you, without that baseline data, without that catalog and the surrounding data with it, we will never get to a place where we're able to say what's next and where's next. So if we don't start with this basic piece, if you will, this catalog, we won't get there. The other thing that something like a global kind of virome project would do is help us look at the extent, the geographic extent, and all of the host extent. So instead of looking at just a few hosts, we mentioned primates, but we look at all the different hosts that viruses are in, we get an idea of how easily they jump from species to species. The more easily a virus jumps, or the more hosts it infects, the more likely it is to be able to get into people, and the more likely it is to be able to become human-to-human spread. If we had put that filter on viruses like Zika virus that we're really worried about all over the world right now, we would have elevated Zika virus on our list of ones to watch. We didn't do that because where it had become endemic, it wasn't causing much disease. But that's what we should expect. Where it's been for hundreds to thousands to millions of years, we don't expect it to be causing horrible disease. But when it moves, either that move is more metaphoric and it moves from species to species, or it moves geographically, like we saw moving to French Polynesia and then South America, then we saw these big changes. And so that's what we want to be able to understand, where things are, what the map looks like, and be able to pick up that movement.
All right, and well, let's do the stereotypical question that everyone asks you when you're having dinner then. What's the next virus then that we should keep an eye on?
Yeah, you sound like my parents, yes, at the holidays. What's next? So I guess I want to tell you instead of naming it, because that would be against our philosophy. Our philosophy is not to worry about the name of the next one, but to be able to detect the next one and be able to look at what's out there. And so the characteristics that, of course, we're most worried about for a human pandemic are direct human-to-human transmission, which is often we're most worried about respiratory transmission, because we can infect a lot of people with one cough or one sneeze. So we worry about that. I think one that's going to come again from the tropics and is going to spill over, but be able to infect many hosts. And that's why we apply this filter when we look. Certainly, we know influenzas are out there, and we do need to be super diligent about influenzas, because we can already predict that it's going to come every year. What we're not so good at yet is predicting which strain and making the right vaccine. Again, getting that atlas, if you will help us with those influenzas, but also everything we talked about, the coronaviruses, the paramyxoviruses, those other viruses that might even be ones that might have a different kind of epidemic, more like the HIV, the retroviruses that we've seen in the past that have been so devastating and continue decades later.
Finally, then, And it's very difficult to reduce an outbreak down to its economic terms, because, of course, these things can be devastating from a human health perspective. And I think it's very important to remember that. But I think the World Bank estimated that the Ebola outbreak cost hundreds of millions of dollars to local economies, certainly in West Africa. And the knock-on effects that, you know, you think of other viruses, Rift Valley fever, which caused huge economic losses in East Africa, for example. I mean, could you put a dollar value on how much this project would cost and its potential savings for if something were to go wrong in the future?
Sure. And I think that's a critically important. We have to consider what it costs. Like you say, costs in human life are most important. To me, also costs in animal life, and I think many of us. But we have to be practical. And what are we spending and what could we save? So if we look at Ebola, for example, it's actually the local economies, the three most affected companies, countries, I believe the estimates are over $4 billion just to those economies. That's not counting your country and mine, what we spent to get all of our hospitals prepared to tear apart airplanes that people were on, things like that. So a large epidemic could reach into the trillions of dollars, one single epidemic. But again, using World Bank estimates, we know that annualized cost, if you spread out over 10 years, the cost of the zoonotic outbreaks that we're seeing, including our preparation and response when we even just get scared of them, we're looking at huge dollars in the billions of dollars every year that we're spending. So we know that a single outbreak can, again, a huge one, a devastating one that takes the world down to its knees, if you will, in the trillions, but a more realistic estimate of these outbreaks that are happening is between $5 and $15 billion every year, annualized over these processes. Now, if we were to go out and discover all the virus that was out there, we think it would take us about 10 years, and it would cost us on the order of $3.5 to $5 billion. Now, if you look at that, that is about 1% of the annualized cost of what we're spending now, but we just spend it differently because there's no choice when these outbreaks happen. We have to respond and we have to be prepared. Instead, if we could get ahead of them and anticipate, we could save so much money, but it does come with a price tag that's quite large in the short term.
Well, Jonna, thank you so much for talking to us today. But where can people find out more about Predict?
Thanks for asking. So we're really proud of our teams all over the world. You can find out more about the project and them at www.predict.global. And if you want to know more about our hopes for the Global Virome Project, that's at globalviromeproject.org.
That's it for this month. If you want to read more about how bats spread Nipah virus by infecting date palm sap with it, visit our blog, The Microbe Post, and check out our On the Horizon article series. Just a heads up, the abstract deadline for the Microbiology Society Annual Conference 2017 is fast approaching on December the 12th. If you want to submit, head to our website, microbiologysociety.org. Extra thanks this month go to Justin Cox at UC Davis for making this happen. Our show was presented by Dr. Benjamin Thompson. It was produced by me, Anand Jagatia. Thanks for listening. See you next time.